yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is the Alternative Vision Show, and again, going solo today. And as promised last week, what I want to do is follow up on the recent midterm elections. What's been the fallout? Now that the dust is clearing a little bit, get a little better picture of what's actually going on. And it doesn't look good. Okay, we have a new Republican-controlled Congress, and this Congress is planning a series of new initiatives, a new corporate offensive, you might say. So what are these new initiatives that are beginning to emerge? Well, we've seen a couple of them already, and they have to do with environmental issues, the XL pipeline. And today, of course, in recent days, we've got this issue with immigration. Okay, and there's at least eight others that we want to talk about here. This is the new legislative agenda of the Republican right new offensive. Okay, and last week's shows, we've talked about how the Democrats and Obama have had failed to resolve the key problems of the U.S. economy and society in the wake of the 2008-2009 crash. We saw and described how they quickly bailed out banker buddies and the very large corporations and wealthy folks in general. And since the 6 years of recovery, the best indicator is that 95% of all the net income gains have gone to the wealthiest 1%. Well, I don't know what other proof you need of who got bailed out and who didn't. 95% for them, and the rest of the 120 million households get the other 5% of all the net gains. Okay. Now, the set of policies that led to this clearly was a set of policies that both parties are responsible for, both Republicans and the Democrats. Okay? And the Democrats could have come up with much more aggressive policies in 2009-10 when they had the chance, when they had control of both houses, veto-proof, filibuster-proof, even in the Senate. They had 60 votes. And they had a majority, safe majority, in the House. And what did we get? We got a recovery program that was extremely minimalist. And $300 billion of the $787 billion of Obama's first recovery went to tax cuts. And people sat on that, most of them businesses. And then we had another $250 billion that went to the states that were supposed to create jobs, but they didn't, and they sat on it. And we had money that went to unemployed and so forth, which was no net additional gain to the economy. In fact, it was less because they were unemployed. So no net real stimulus to the economy. And then $100 billion, which was stretched out over 10 years for infrastructure, which is no effect whatsoever. And even in Congress, Democrats were begging Obama, please, please, we need at least $150, $200 billion more than your $787 billion. And some of them were saying, no, we need $1.3 trillion. And Obama, as a result of recommendations of his advisors, like Larry Summers and others, made the recovery program as small as they possibly could, $787 billion. And the composition of that was poor. It didn't really go into the hands of people who needed it to spend. And after a year, it dissipated. And the economy was back in a decline and a retreat by the summer of 2010. And what did Obama do in 2010? Ignore the economy. And what happened was focused on financial reform to get anything he could, which was very weak, and gave 4 years for bankers to pick it apart, which they've done. And he came up with this phony Affordable Care Act that gave some benefits to a few and gave huge subsidies to the health insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and others. You know, the ACA is not a health care reform bill. It is a health insurance company subsidy bill. That's what it is. And as I said many times, this thing will unravel eventually. Okay, so, and it is unraveling as we speak. We've had shows on that. Okay, so while Obama was busy with that, in 2010, the economy is getting worse. 14 million people eventually foreclosed, lost their homes. Hundreds of thousands more were being laid off in the summer. Instead of that, he turned his jobs program over to the CEO of General Electric, Jeff Immelt, whose idea of job creation was free trade. And the Democrats got shellacked, as I've said before, in the November 2010 midterms. All that big margin of victory they had in the House of Representatives 2008, because people clearly realized the Republicans had screwed up. You know, okay, we're going to give the Democrats a big chance here. So they swept in the House. They got swept out after 2 years. All right, and because the Senate takes six-year terms, what happened was the senators who rode in on that 2008 wave did not get swept out until the recent midterms, 2014 midterms. Okay, so now we got Republicans back in control of the Senate and the House, and they're full of their typical arrogance, and they believe the presidency is, you know, just a step away from them in 2016. So they're their old arrogant selves again, coming up with solutions for their rich buddies once again. And that's what we're about to see. That's what the new offensive is here, or the renewed offensive. We're going to see that this corporate offensive has come in several waves ever since the 1970s. And this is only the fourth wave that's coming. So what we're seeing next few weeks and months that will be developed by the Republican-controlled Congress is a back-to-the-future, back to George W. Bush policies, old wine in new bottles, as they say, and a continuation of this 40-year political cycle in the U.S. where Republicans wreck the economy to make their wealthy benefactors and campaign contributors richer than ever before. Then the Democrats come in and promise to correct the wreckage, but they don't. They correct it. They bail out the rich folks again, who get richer in the recovery. 95% of all income gains gone to the 1% since 2009. What other proof do you need? The rest of us, median, at the median family income, down 1% to 2% per year, every year, ever since. And folks below that, even worse off. You know? Republicans wreck it and make the rich richer. Democrats come in, screw up the recovery, and make the rich even richer. That's the 40-year cycle. And people forget, after 4 years, of the wreckage the Republicans did. Okay, it's not that everyone voted for the Republicans in the last midterm. It's that most people got fed up and didn't vote at all. It was the worst turnout in decades in midterm elections. People voted with their feet. They didn't show up to support the Democrats. Well, who can blame them? They didn't solve people's problems. Oh, they talk about 6 million jobs. Yeah, well, 6 million part-time temp jobs, low pay, no benefits. 8 million left the labor force altogether. We've got fewer union workers, union members today than we did when the thing started 6 years ago. So, union higher paid workers didn't benefit. We've had a destruction of full-time permanent jobs consistently for 6 years. So, you know, I mean, look at the facts, folks. Look at the facts. It's the same crap going on in Europe, of course. We see the same thing there. But, you know, they got a parliamentary system which allows new parties and new ideas to emerge, both left and right. But at least there's an opportunity. But not in the USA. No, sir, we don't have a parliamentary system. We have the most conservative political structure in the developed world. And it was set up that way, fixed that way, way back when the U.S. Constitution was established. Let's do a little history here. Okay, Americans don't know their own history. Let's step back. Let's step back and look at how this system was set up originally to be super conservative on behalf of the wealthy and the powerful. Let's go back to the U.S. Constitutional Convention of 1787. A kind of legal coup d'etat, a bloodless coup d'etat on behalf of wealthy bondholders. Others have written about this from time to time, academics and others, muckrakers, pointing this out. If you look at revolutionary America back in 1776 to 1783, during the Revolutionary War, okay, what do you see? You see a very democratic, active farmers and workers at the local level. We had a real democracy back then during the war, and the rich folks put up with it because they wanted to win the war. They wanted to throw the British out because the British were crimping their style and their ability to make profits. You know, the British were taxing them, and you had to send your goods only to London. You couldn't sell it anywhere you wanted in the world, and you could only buy stuff from London. The British had a stranglehold on trade to and from the U.S. You had to use British banks. You couldn't create your own banks. You had to ship on British ships and pay exorbitant prices to ship and everything. So no wonder the nascent U.S. capitalists at the time were chapping at the bit here with the British and wanted a revolution too. Okay, so they put up with the people wanting a revolution as well. And they got it. And they won the war with the help of the French and the Dutch and their money. But during this period, 1776-83, you know, we developed a real vibrant state and local democracy. Farmers, independent yeoman farmers in particular, and workers controlled the state legislatures. And often those legislatures were only one-house legislatures. They weren't bicameral, as they say. You know, the states did not have a Senate and a House. Well, a couple of them did, but most of them were single. And people were elected for 1 year, maybe 2 years at the very most. Judges were elected. There was no imperial executive, the governors could not override the legislature, right? And the units, the representative units, were very small. In other words, your representative knew you because, you know, his jurisdiction did not go very far. We had direct democracy at a lot of local levels then. After 1783 and the war ended, of course, there was a severe depression in 1783 to 1787. Severe depression. We don't have good data, so it often isn't reported, but it was a terrible depression. Couldn't get the economy going again. Well, you know, we were so dependent on British trade and so forth. When that got cut off after 1783, there was nobody to trade with. We didn't have banks. We didn't have a merchant marine. We didn't have lots of things. And the country was in deep debt to finance the war. All the rich folks put up money, not all of them, some of them aligned with the British. Rich folks put up money, and, you know, so did the Dutch and the French put up money to fight the war. And when the war was ended, they wanted their money. They wanted to be paid their bonds, debts. And what you got was the rich folks in the new states said, okay, all you farmers, you got to raise your taxes so we can pay ourselves off, and so we can pay the French, wealthy French and Dutch off. In other words, big bond debts. Someone got to be paid, and the rich wanted to be paid, both U.S. and foreign rich. So the only people you can get, you could squeeze it out of where the farmers. So raise taxes on the farmers. The farmer says, wait a minute, no way. You know, why should we pay for the war for you rich folks? And, of course, the farmers had control of the state and local government, and they said no. And those legislatures in the states that attempted to do it, the farmers did what? They occupied. They went to these legislatures, sat in, sat down, threw these guys out if they voted to raise their taxes to pay the debts for the rich. So the big issue was, who was going to pay these bond debts? If the farmers wouldn't allow their taxes to be raised, who was going to put? The money was worthless during currency during that time. Couldn't get the economy going. Right? Who would pay the rich? And who would pay for a standing army, by the way, and a standing navy? And it was important because, you got to have wars to get your share of the markets in the world. That hasn't changed. Okay, so farmer state governments had to be neutralized. Direct democracy had to be neutralized, had to be blunted, had to be taken over. And that's the only way the rich saw that they could get out of the Depression and get paid. And we almost had a second revolution in 1786, 1787, when the farmers were rising up, places like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, because of the attempts to tax them and attempts to take over their state legislatures even further, right? Oh, and then we have the Founding Fathers come along. There was a crisis. There was a depression. What's the solution? Most people said, well, we got to strengthen the government somehow, come up with some way of figuring out how we pay these debts and pay taxes without, throwing people into economic crisis here. So the so-called Founding Fathers snuck off to Philadelphia. They were told that we just want you to amend our existing form of government, but they threw it all out. And they came up with a totally new form of government that gave the federal government extreme powers. First and foremost, to pay the bondholders. You see, that's what the Constitution was all about. How do we pay these bondholders? And how do we check this unruly democracy going on at the state and local level? These farmers are actually running the show. We got to do both of those at the same time. Well, the U.S. Constitution, if you look at it clearly, comes up with an economic solution. And this was done by the folks that went to the Constitution Convention, 50, 60 of them, most of them, who were owed lots of money. Today we would say there'd be conflict of interest. You couldn't participate in those kind of discussions. But they were mostly commercialists, shippers and so forth from New England and bankers from New York and big plantation owners. And they wanted to get paid their bonds. And they wanted to pay the French and the Dutch because they wanted to trade with them, so they wanted to pay them off too. So how did they do it? Well, they took over all the western lands from the states that had claims, and now they were going to start selling these western lands to raise money to pay their bonds. And they set off what would be a century of land speculation in different forms in this country. Financial speculation in real estate is part of the structure of this country. We were born as financial real estate speculators, and it's in our DNA. It's in the capitalist DNA here in America. And we're going to sell off these lands, and then we're going to take over all tariffs, all taxes on trade, so they raise money that way. Okay, then how do you tame the state and local governments that were being run by farmers? Well, you set up a political structure that makes the federal government supreme over the state and local governments. Commerce Clause, Supremacy Clause, all these clauses in the Constitution. But even more so, you tell the states, state governments, you don't have to pay your debts anymore, the bond debts to the rich. We will pay. We, the new federal government, will pay the bond debts. Oh, well, so, you know, gee, take my debts and I'll give up some of my political control. And that's what happened. It was a trade-off. We're going to pay your state debts and you give us some of your political control. And that's exactly what happened. And that's how we got the U.S. Constitution, a tit-for-tat, quid pro quo, give up local democracy in exchange for we'll pay your debts. And that means the central government became even more powerful. And what did the political structure look like at the federal level? Well, it wasn't all that democratic. No, sir. Now we have two houses of Congress, you know? If we get too many radical people in the House of Representatives, we got the Senate to slow it down 6 years. And the Senate was not elected. They were appointed. Only the House of Representatives were elected. And the political units were made geographically even larger so they would be out of touch with their local constituents. No direct election of the Senate, no direct election of the President, which still exists. You know, in a real crisis, the capitalists can say, oh, well, we don't care if there was a majority voting for the president. We'll just get our safe and proven electors to vote for the right person. That's never come up yet. We've come close, but that will happen. Of course, no women could vote. Slaves were counted as voters but couldn't vote. And even in certain states, you had to have certain property to vote. And election periods were no longer 1 year or 2 years at most. Now they were 4 years and 6 years. Not a very democratic arrangement compared to what went on in the states. Check the power of the people is what it was all about. And on top of that, we imposed thereafter the Constitution, this two-party system. And then in 1806, we give the Supreme Court, unelected old men, the ability, they simply assumed it, we didn't even give it to them, they assumed it, to declare laws of the people unconstitutional. And then in 1914, we created a Federal Reserve to bail out the bankers. So you see, we have this institutional structure which not only checks real democracy from below, but makes it almost impossible to resist institutionally. Ever since 1787, American people have been fighting to take back their democracy. We have to fight to free the slaves and enfranchise African Americans. We have to fight for women's right to vote. We have a fight to form unions and have a voice in, you know, one-third of your lives. In the 1930s, we had the fight for the civil rights. We're still fighting civil rights as they're trying to take away voting rights today in many states. And today, what's the fight? The fight is against corporations as citizens, corporate personhood, you know, which paved the way for even more money in politics, right? Turn the First Amendment on us, against us, right? Declare corporations as persons, and therefore we come up with Citizens United Supreme Court decisions that says, okay, so they're persons, they can spend all the money they want. Corporations own the political system today, right? And we're fighting against that. Deepening corporate control of our government and political system. That's what the democratic fight is today, right? We're fighting to even keep our unions as they're being destroyed right and left. We're fighting to prevent the denial of our democratic rights that we see everywhere. And we're fighting against government spying and the basic civil liberties restrictions and taking away of civil liberties, and we're fighting to have our own independent political organizations and voice instead of this flip-flop, you know, Republicans wreck it, Democrats come in, fail to correct it, and we go on and no Third Voice as an opportunity to get involved. It's a winner take all, right? No openings, right? Today we have a new Republican corporate offensive in the making. Right? The latest expression of what I've just described historically has been going on for centuries. All right, the latest corporate offensive. If you go back to the 60s and 1960s and 1970s, you know, we had the groundwork being laid for the first offensive. We have all these assassinations in the 60s, people who thought that they, you know, had democratic rights, even presidents thought they were president, found out that certain people with real power didn't think they were. I'm talking about JFK. I'm talking about, you know, his brother, RFK, trying to reestablish, you know, the last presidents who thought they were presidents. And then, of course, we have all the domestic assassinations that went on in the 60s and all the spying by the FBI and everything. Nixon comes in and, you know, he was attempting to do that in his second term, you know, to solidify this corporate control. But he screwed up. He got caught in Watergate and a terrible depression. Recession of 73-75 set in and terrible inflation set in. He screwed up and slowed up the whole process. But the first offensive really gets going, corporate offensive, in the late 1970s, and Ronald Reagan takes it and runs with it on behalf of corporate interests. And what did he deliver? Well, he delivered quite a bit for those folks. Financial deregulation, right? Big tax cuts, record tax cuts, destruction of the pension system, replacing it with privatized 401k plans. Contingent workers began to grow in temps and part-times, offshoring of jobs and offshoring of much of a manufacturing base in this country, attempts at trade regulation, right? Deficits, the big deficits of trade, big deficits of budget and government debt began with Ronald Reagan. How anybody could believe Ronald Reagan was great for this country. He set in motion the problems that we have today. Yes, they call it neoliberalism. I don't care what you call it. I don't like that term. But, you know, it's Ronald Reagan on behalf of the corporate offensive. That was launched in the late 70s, I said, under Jimmy Carter, and then really accelerated under Ronald Reagan. And then what did we get with Bill Clinton? Well, we got more free trade. We got an extension of the Reagan offensive. We got more, even more free trade. We got even more corporate tax cuts, eliminated welfare, right? We get a phony solution to the health care cost crisis that really says to health insurance companies, okay, you guys can get bigger and gouge people even more. That's what managed health care was all about. We get a destruction of defined benefit plans even further, big time financial further deregulation, and even further opening to China and the loss of jobs, and bankers taking over the political system. That's what we got under Clinton. And everybody thinks Bill Clinton, oh, if we can only go back to the days of Clinton. Well, look, folks, what it was. You're not looking at the facts. Well, facts are clouded because, totally unrelated to Bill Clinton, we had this technology wave coming, the digital technology wave, that created some jobs for a while, 4 or 5 years, and then those jobs sort of stagnated as well. And everyone thinks that was Bill Clinton. Well, Clinton had absolutely nothing to do with that. But he identifies himself with it. And then we get George W. Bush, Reagan, accelerated, Reagan on steroids, the third offensive. Even more tax cuts, even more free trade, Central American free trade, bilateral agreements, financial deregulation run amok, further destruction of pensions and the health care system and wages and unions. It's all continuous, all of this. Which brings us to Obama. And how do we see Obama in this picture, the Obama period? Well, now it's becoming clear. First offensive under Reagan, extending that offensive under Clinton, accelerating that corporate offensive under George W. Bush, and now rescuing that offensive, rescuing neoliberalism. That's what Obama has been about. And now that his term is ending, his role in this whole historical development is coming to a close. What we got is the new fourth offensive beginning to take shape, led by the Republicans in Congress. It's going to roll out and take shape, you know, piecemeal here, but we can already see some of the outlines of it. When I said that Obama rescued neoliberalism, well, as we've talked about before, $14 trillion to bail out the banks, $5 trillion in corporate tax cuts, more free trade he's pushing for, you know, his bilateral agreements, several of them he negotiated. Now this TPP thing, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and its analog in Europe, TTIP and Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, you know, so even a bigger free trader. Tax cuts for corporations. We have this so-called Dodd-Frank bill, which is really just a farce, a financial re-regulation, bank re-regulation cover-up. That's all this is. Anybody who knows what's going on knows that the Dodd-Frank financial terms and conditions aren't going to have the slightest impact on preventing another financial crisis. We have this big surge in contingent jobs, an even further decline in unions, a tax on public workers, which he promised to defend when he ran for office and hasn't said a peep, a word, defending public workers, immigrant workers. Yeah, okay, we got this big immigration thing going on right now. I'll talk about that shortly, but look, Obama has deported more immigrants than any other president. 438,000 alone last year, which was 50,000 more than the year before and 30,000 more than the year before that. Over 2 million. And then he has the gall to stand up there yesterday and say, to talk about deportation. He's not going to deport. And by the way, many, many, most of these were families being broken up. Well, no wonder Hispanics did not turn out to vote for Democrats. You know, the non-bank companies, non-bank financial companies, the bankers got $14 trillion under Obama. And the non-bank multinationals got more bilateral free trade. They got to keep more than $2 trillion in their profits untaxed in their offshore subsidiaries. And they're expanding that with all this tax inversion recent moves. They got a blind eye by Congress and Obama for proliferating their offshore tax shelters and tax avoidance. Businesses and wealthy investors got more than $5 trillion in tax cuts passed in 2009, 2010, and again in 2012 for the next decade. They got $4 trillion in continuing tax cuts between 2012 and 2022. So it's not just the bankers got bailed out, you know, it's the non-bankers that got bailed out free money for a long, long time. And what about the oil and energy companies? Well, under Obama, they got a green light to frack gas and oil anywhere in the country. Companies after companies, coal companies, you know, got to dump coal ash and chemicals in U.S. rivers at will, poisoning our drinking water supplies in countless communities. And they've gotten permission to continue to emit thousands of additional tons of dangerous metals into the U.S. atmosphere every year that continues to cause an epidemic in human nervous system diseases and disorders in this country. And now, just recently, a rule was passed where they can frack on the eastern forests and parks as much as they want. Free hand to frack, right? Which means poison the water supply. That's what fracking does. It poisons the water supply. And it also emits more methane gas than it reduces in carbon dioxide gas. So net greenhouse gas emissions go up. And what did the Pentagon companies get? Pentagon and defense companies get? Well, they got trillions or more dollars in war contracts from Afghanistan to North Africa under Barack Obama. And they're lining up at the trough here for even more contracts for U.S. military pivot to Asia that's underway. All right, the bankers got their phony Dodd-Frank bill, as we said, in addition to $14 trillion. Insurance companies, big pharmaceuticals, got their Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, which insured them tens of billions of dollars in new revenue. I mean, we should really call this the Health Insurance Company Subsidy Act. Ah, what about politically, the neocons? Well, it's becoming pretty clear that the neocons were able, despite their clear fault, and you know, the whole Iraq war was really a neocon initiative here, going back to the early days of Bush. Even before 9/11, the neocons were pushing hard, you know. They had their white papers and reports, you know, as Clinton was going out and Bush was coming in. It was very clear. They were talking about invading Iraq long before 9/11. 9/11 gave them the okay. And we know what happened there. Well, the neocons got even deeper into the U.S. State Department under Obama, thanks in large part to Hillary Clinton. Right? And they're pushing even deeper for conflicts. They're the ones behind pushing for, you know, conflicts in Syria. Let's arm the rebels and get involved there in Syria. Almost went to war here. Another war front a year ago, and that was only stopped because the U.S. people said, "No, we had a fill of this," and also because even the generals themselves says, "No more fronts." And, of course, the neocons are deeply behind this coup d'etat in Ukraine, Virginia Nuland, and everything, you know, that pushed into the Ukraine, precipitated this coup of an elected government in Ukraine. Now, you may not like that government. I didn't like that government. And Yanukovych, you know, and look, the poor Ukrainian people, they've been ripped off by these capitalist oligarchs on both sides for 20 years. You know, the pro-Russian oligarchs and the pro-Western oligarchs, you know, two wolf packs that have been devouring everybody. And they're fed up with it over there, but they're caught in the middle. And, you know, this whole coup d'etat was for the Western wolf pack of oligarchs to prevail over the Russian wolf pack of oligarchs. That's all. This is a fight at the top. Okay, and they use the the neocons in the State Department, you know, have been funding on the ground these proto-fascist movements. They call them ultra-nationalists. Well, they're fascist, right? To the tune of $5 billion over the last decade. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of payments. People on your paycheck, on the ground there. You know, a lot of free time, get paid and stir up trouble, right? And, of course, the neocons are all for preventing any agreement with Iran and provoking a fight with Iran. And, of course, you know, deep in the neocon group is a strong Israeli group. And they're the ones behind pushing NATO to and sanctions against Russia and trying to move NATO to provoke into the eastern areas, eastern countries, you know, Georgia, Moldova, Ukraine. They want NATO. They want NATO membership for these people because they know it will mean a Russian confrontation. But that's what they want. They want a Russian confrontation. They want Russian invasions to provoke, you know, a bigger fight. Environmental groups, immigration groups have been successfully blocked time and time again under Obama. We talked about all the solutions, which have been pretty much, let's deport folks. That's been the policy to date. And by the way, that was an executive policy. Obama didn't need to do that. So he was blocked by the Republicans from getting the Dream Act or whatever, but he didn't need to deport people. Yeah, he was just trying to curry their support. So look how tough I am getting rid of all these immigrants. Okay, let's negotiate the bill. Republicans say, well, good, but no. Right? And environmental rollbacks everywhere. Obama telling the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to back off on industrial emissions time and again. And go slow, back off, and let them do what they want with fracking, gas fracking. That's the solution, right? Okay. At the same time, we got voting rights and basic civil liberties progressively chipped away at the margin by dozens of U.S. states under Obama. Journalists, government corruption whistleblowers, hounded, harassed, indicted by federal and state attorneys general alike. Police militarization, military tactics against U.S. citizens becoming common practice. Spying, electronic surveillance on innocent U.S. citizens, now in the extreme. Most Americans are not even aware of the extent to which their democracy has been restricted and dismantled under the Democratic Party-controlled Congress since 2009. And that's going to get all worse. All of that is going to get worse under the fourth offensive here that's about to take shape. Well, what does that fourth offensive involve? All right, I'm going to give you a list of issues to look for. Some of them are already becoming fact here. Okay, first, we've seen immigration reform. On the agenda, immigration reform. That's part of the Republican offensive. But for the Republicans, it means more police, more border fences, no Dream Act, no path to citizenship. Now, Obama is trying to be very clever here. You know, he's come out with very minimalist executive order action, executive action. He's got a right to do that, of course. I mean, it's so minimal. Look at it. What does he say? We're going to go slow on the deportations, right? And in addition to that, people can get to the back of the line if you pay up your taxes. I don't know how much people are going to have to pay. If you pay a fee, no one knows how much more you're going to have to pay a fee, and go to the back of the line. Well, that's nothing different than U.S. law already. He's not doing anything different than exists. All he's really saying is, well, maybe I won't go as hard with the deportations while we negotiate with Congress. Whoop-de-doo. No big deal there. Nothing new there. He's not giving these folks anything. And Republicans know it, but they still don't want to agree to it because they don't want to have an agreement. They want to keep whacking him and the Democrats over the head with this until 2016. All they want is border fences and more police. That's what they want. But Obama thinks that, okay, by doing this executive action, I will provoke them into writing some legislation that I'll quickly sign no matter what it is and say, okay, that's the best we could do. You see, that's the strategy here. This is just a tactic. It's executive action to have them, provoke them, the Republican Congress, to come up with something, anything, and I'll vote for it. What is this? This is triangulation. This is Clintonian triangulation in specific form. That's what this immigration fight is about. How about environmental? Oh, Republicans want to roll back everything. Oh, they almost got it with a vote to, pass the XL pipeline. Totally unnecessary. We have such a glut of oil and a glut of gas in this country that the prices of gas and oil are collapsing. So they want more? That's just to export. That's all that is. Oh, and the Republicans say, we're going to create tens of thousands of jobs. Building the pipeline. But you know how many jobs it's going to take to run the pipeline after it's built? 35 jobs, permanent long-term jobs. And Republicans are doing everything they can to roll back industrial plant emissions by the EPA on old and new plants. And Obama will, compromise with them on that. And then this thing about USA and China, both USA and China announcing, you know, they're going to cut back emissions. There's nothing new there in either side that they already had agreed to or publicly said they would do. Nothing. It's a publicity tactic on both parts. But the Republicans are going to want to roll back. They're going to cut the EPA even more. They will get their XL pipeline because they will roll it in and attach it to another bill, appropriations bill or something, and then Obama will have to agree to it because the rest of the bill will have to be passed. You see, that's what he's planning to do here. You know, vote, oppose the XL, and then when he puts up a token fight, then it gets passed, and he's going to say, well, I'm forced to. What else are we going to see here? We're going to see more corporate tax cuts. That's coming very soon. Both Obama and the Republicans are for reducing corporate tax rates from 35% to the mid-20s. They're both on record for years in that regard. And they will provide some cover for themselves by some rules for tax inversion limits, some token loophole closings maybe. But that will pass, corporate tax cuts. That's very high. You see, that's even higher on the Republican agenda than immigrant reform, immigrant rights, and environmental issues. But that's coming. That's going to be another big concession to tax cuts for corporations, right? Fast-track global free trade agreement in Asia, in Europe. Oh, they're all on the same page as far as that's concerned. They both want global free trade agreements, okay? And they'll sell this with the false lie that it has something to do with creating jobs when it actually has just the opposite. And by the way, if they agree to this TPP, you know, that's a treaty. And what that means, that becomes the hammer to roll back even existing environmental legislation. Clean water, clean air, you know? Free trade agreements, plus, you know, tar sands and pipeline, plus stop industrial plant emission plans, disaster for the environment. But that's what's coming as well. Financial deregulation. Minimum bank capital requirements are being removed time and time again. Living wills. In other words, what are your plans for becoming bankrupt if you have to? And SEC, Security Exchange Commission, charges against banks. You know, every week there's obvious something that they're being discovered on. Manipulating interest rates and foreign exchange and LIBOR and all this stuff. The banks haven't stopped. Right? And they will pull back, Congress will pull back even these token attempts to regulate them. Syria, ISIL, Iraq, more U.S. weapons, that's coming. More boots on the ground in Iraq, that's coming. De facto, third war in Iraq, coming. Ukraine, more military aid directly to the coup government, the Poroshenko government. More advisors, military advisors, already on the ground. U.S. special ops, already on the ground. And more direct U.S. involvement in Ukraine. That's coming. More sanctions on Europe, particularly. Let's push these Europeans who don't want to impose sanctions, because they're the ones who are being impacted negatively by it more than U.S. U.S. trade with Russia is minimal. Right? The U.S. wants to sever the growing relationship that has occurred in the last decade between Russia and Europe, particularly Germany and Eastern Europe, which are dependent for 30-40%, in some cases 100% of all their energy from Russia. Russia is getting too deeply connected economically with the Eurozone. They want to stop that. They want to keep Europe dependent on the U.S. economically. So they're doing everything they can to precipitate a conflict between Russia and Europe, economically and otherwise. And NATO, you know, is clearly the linchpin for that. Stir up the shit there, with in the Ukraine and use that as a way to enforce a break economically between Russia and Western Europe. That's the neocon strategy. And to really accelerate that, push NATO into Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, where votes are being encouraged to be taken shortly, for them to join NATO. That will precipitate a direct conflict. Ukraine going NATO guaranteed a conflict between NATO and the Russians. Russians will never allow that. To them, this is all beginning to look like, you know, 1939. More tax by U.S. states on union membership, union rights, and pensions are coming as well. And more freedom of action to the National Security Agency, NSA, and other government spying and for spying and surveillance on U.S. citizens. They've already voted down a tepid attempt in the Senate to put some sort of reporting on what the NSA is doing as far as spying on U.S. citizens is concerned. They already shot that down, you know, in the Senate. So you're going to see these at least 10 major offensives coming. Corporate tax cuts, just to summarize, free trade, environmental rollbacks, revising the Affordable Care Act revisions, in other words, shifting more costs to consumers, lifting mandates on businesses, Medicaid reform, more financial deregulation, lifting, fight over immigration reform, Syria, ISIL, Iraq, Ukraine, Russia, U.S. states continuing their attacks on unions. Look, you know, the Republicans won like two-thirds of the state governorships. More importantly, this guy Walker in Kasich in Ohio, Walker in Wisconsin, you know, they prevailed again. Oh, that's going to embolden them, the Republicans, the Koch brothers, ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, to push right to work, in other words, prevent unionization into other states now. That's coming. New offensive there as well. And a new offensive to spy and deepen and allow big government agencies to continue to spy on U.S. citizens. Those are the 10 or 12 elements of the new offensive that we can see. And, you know, this offensive is really two-sided. One, to give corporations more economic and political rights and freedom and opportunities to make even more money at our expense, and to constrict and limit and roll back, you know, whatever gains have been made on other fronts by workers of various kinds. You know, immigration, those are workers. You know, there's not a lot of rich folks there. Oh, by the way, I should say that one of the other provisions that Obama has talked about, if you listen to him clearly, was to allow immigrants who played by the rules to stay here. Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about H-1B visas and L-1 visas that the big tech companies who provide a lot of money to Democrat elections want. They want to bring more people over here. Hundreds of thousands, just as they did under Clinton, by the way, hundreds of thousands a year, to take these high-tech jobs. No, I mean, these are multinational corporations, and they bring these people over here, and they work 2, 3, 4 years here, and then they send them back to their other subsidiaries around the globe. And it's cheap, and they don't have to train people here. You see, they don't want to train people. That costs money. They don't want to give these jobs to Americans. They say, oh, well, you know, gee, we would give them to Americans if they you know, were qualified. Well, you used to train these folks in the past, AT&T and others. They had tremendous training programs. No more. They got rid of all those. So they just pull on all these people from other countries, you know. Bring them in here and let them work here. And, of course, you pay them whatever you want. You don't have to pay them U.S. market prices. And then you send them back to your subsidiaries. And that way you don't have to hire Americans. H-1B, L-1. L-1's management, and L-2 is management spouses. H-1B is skilled workers. That's in this immigration bill. You see, that's what business wants out of this bill. And that's what's coming. And then we said Syria, Ukraine, Russia, neocons on the march once again. Get a big push in this Congress coming up. And then a big attack on pensions, both public and not public. Wipe out what's left of real pensions, defined benefit pensions. I'm talking about phony 401k plans that provide an average of only $18,000 on average. How are you going to retire on that? Impossible. You know, that was the cover to destroy the real pension system in this country. And then more limitations on civil liberties. We're going to see all that come. That's all part. All of this is part of the new corporate offensive that's taking shape now in a very, very early stage, but you can see it. You know, we've been hearing about immigration reform and hearing about environmental issues, but this is just the beginning. You know, the big ones that they want to tackle next are big corporate tax cuts and free trade. That's high in the agenda. And then they're going to chip away the Affordable Care Act, what's left of it, right, and chip away even more aggressively on the Financial Regulation Act, Dodd-Frank, and foreign policy and civil liberties. This is all part of the fourth offensive. It's all one offensive, really. You know, it sort of ebbs and flows. And the way to think of this is, you know, this really begins in the 70s and 80s. Some call, academics call this neoliberalism. But it's all about destroying unions, holding back workers' power and ability to get raises and protect themselves at the work level and social programs, you know, at the political level. Hold those all in abeyance and check why you do everything you can to expand corporate profits and capital gains for the wealthy investors continue the shift of income and money from the rest of us to the wealthiest 1%, you know, now going at 95%. That's what it's all about, you see. And all this are... Well, you know, it's just a question of strategy and tactics. The first offensive under Ronald Reagan, right? And that stalls after a while in the late 80s, and then it's revived under Bill Clinton in different forms with a little different emphasis, more on free trade, you know, more on financial deregulation than even Reagan. We take general deregulation, we turn to financial deregulation, and in the meantime, you know, you let the financial elite get a bigger control of the government, and all these other things I talked about under Clinton. Clinton gets in trouble at the end of his eight-year term, and then George Bush comes in and reaccelerates Reagan on steroids, offensive. Then you have the financial crash, and everything gets stalled on their behalf, and in comes Obama, who rescues neoliberalism, and then... Now that it's been rescued, what we're beginning to see is the new offensive taking shape. The rest of the world's in terrible economic and political shape, very weak. The U.S. Has exported part of its economic problems to the rest of the world because it has the global currency, and its central bank kind of runs it globally. And what you've got is now the new offensive. But, you know, the U.S. is going to have to face the challenge of the Chinese, and even those Russians, even they are getting uppity again. And then you got, all the people in the Muslim world who won't lay down, and you got people in Latin America who got a taste of more democratic control of their lives and their futures. They're not going to give that up, you know. They're going to continue to fight for it. And then you got what's going on in Mexico, where people are really going to rise up, I predict here, now that it's become clear that the government and the state is really the other flip side of the narco. In the narco system down there, narco government system. Very dangerous for for the Mexican elite. You know, now that their government is being identified as part and parcel of the narcos. So we will watch Mexico very closely, what happens there, and everywhere. Everywhere, it's not a clear control. Okay, that that does it for our session today. Watch for, the, in the wake of the midterms, the new corporate offensive, and driven by the new Republican Congress. And now that Obama's rescue of the system is over, and it should prove very interesting. In coming weeks, what we're going to do is look at the rest of the global economy. We're going to take a look at what's happening in Japan economically, what's happening in the Ukraine, getting much worse, the Eurozone entering a new recession, and so forth. Okay, so we'll return to the global economic scene in the coming weeks here, now that we've been talking about the U.S. Democratic midterm elections on several occasions. So join me next week when we look at Japan's fourth recession in as many as 5 years. Japan's fourth recession. And if we have time, Ukraine's deepening economic crisis. Next week on Alternative Visions.